Hello, and welcome to Jason Major's Sex Party. This podcast is dedicated to a sex-positive worldview. Basically, the idea is that you should have fun, be safe, and explore. I think that sex is a subject that we as a society need to spend more time exploring. So what makes me qualified to head up this particular expedition? Well, I am no stranger to the world of earthly pleasures. My name is Jason Major, and I have sex. I'm a cisgendered, heterosexual man who just turned 40. I've never been married. I've got no kids. I've been a swinger for the past 15 years, and I'm currently in ethically non-monogamous polyamorous relationships with multiple women who are all fully aware of each other. I watch pornography. I've visited sex workers. I have shared cocktails with porn stars. I have been to and even hosted sex parties. Basically, I'm your average run-of-the-mill American pervert with one important exception. Unlike most of you out there, I'm out and I'm proud about my perversions. I embrace who I am and what I want. I'm honest with myself and other people. I find sex to be one of the most fascinating subjects there is. So I put together this little homage to the great and powerful Ira Glass in order to explore the world of sex one subject at a time. So let's get things started, shall we? The theme of the party today is homophobia. I'd like to start off the show today by talking about the influence that religion has on homophobia. As I record this, the Kim Davis story appears to have come to a close for the time being. Thank the Maker. In case this podcast has been downloaded by alien robots 10,000 years in the future, Kim Davis is the Rowan County, Kentucky clerk who disagrees with the Supreme Court ruling that legalized same-sex marriages and decided not to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples who requested them because Jesus. She was jailed for contempt of court after refusing to issue these marriage licenses, and she has claimed that forcing her to do so would violate her religious freedom. Well, she's been released from jail to the raucous applause of many, many bigots. However, she is currently following the court order to not interfere with her subordinates issuing marriage licenses. Kim Davis and her supporters claim that this is all about religious freedom. Now, enough people have piled on to these look, I don't want to offend these people, so let's just call them morons. But enough people have already harped on about Kim Davis's multiple marriages and the obvious hypocrisy in ignoring far more explicit biblical laws while overemphasizing the few passages that are even slightly anti-gay. But what is it about these morons that makes them see their own gay panic in a religion that is obviously based around loving others? Well, I think the problem is simple. It's their religion itself. Before you issue a Christian fatwa or anything, don't misunderstand my position here, okay? I think that there is no real problem with the religion as a whole, well, for the most part. The problem is the fucked up way that we exercise our freedom of religion in the United States. So I'm going to take this as a golden opportunity to talk about religion. Oh, I can taste those angry hate tweets now. Kim Davis and her supporters believe that the Christian God who created the universe, our planet, and the people who dwell on said inhabitable rock cares very deeply who consensually touches your genitals. He's also very concerned with whether you sleep around a lot, use birth control, or vote Democrat, but weirdly not about the poor and the sick. But I digress. These Christians believe that the Bible is 100% true, and it details specifically how being gay is bad. For the record, it doesn't. It totally doesn't. The Bible certainly doesn't recommend homosexuality, but it treats it with the same disgust reserved for a night out at the Red Lobster or a Cotton Poly blend. Regardless, they believe these things. And you can't argue with belief. Mostly because they'll argue back loudly and with a lot more spittle. However, I do believe that reason wins. Eventually. You see, I believe in the power of reason and evidence because I, myself, hold a very strong set of personal beliefs. I don't believe in any organized religion, although I did give money to John Oliver's Our Lady of the Perpetual Exemption while it existed. That was really more just in the hopes of a shout-out on air, though. I love you, John! Nope, I don't believe in the teachings of the Christian Bible, or the Torah, or the Quran. All good books, by the way. They're all kind of based on the same thing. I don't believe in Hindu gods, or Buddha, or Lord Xenu. I believe in Star Trek. specifically the next generation. Although some Voyager does creep in from time to time. Fuck J.J. Abrams. I believe that the stories of the Starship Enterprise and its Federation crew exploring the Alpha Quadrant make for a far superior religious text than anything else out there today. Think about the show. If you've never seen it, then turn this off and Netflix it immediately. Basically, it's about a diverse crew exploring new worlds and civilizations in the future world of the 24th century aboard a giant, technologically advanced starship. But rewatching some episodes recently, it struck me. I never realized how much of an influence the show had on me growing up. Next Generation premiered September 28th, 1987, just after my 12th birthday. I was never much of a Star Trek fan, but something about this iteration drew me in. I devoured the series, and I would credit that show with my love of sci-fi today. But looking back at the show as a whole, I realized that the series is composed of tiny little morality tales. Little lessons on everything from tolerance to genocide. Spoiler alert, pro-tolerance, anti-genocide. Basically, the fine people over at Paramount Studios have presented us with a ready-to-go religion for the modern world. Because I think this may be where my problem in the Bible lies. 2,000 years ago, there was no such concept as the printing press, much less Twitter or whatever next social media abomination I'll be forced to learn as an old person. I'm not sure there is any other avenue in the world where we look at the way of thinking from 2,000 years ago and say, well, we can't argue with that. The text of the Bible is from a world as different from today as any alien civilization. But Star Trek, it's not about the past, it's about the future. Of course, does that really justify it as a religious text? Well, let's look at the way I view the world and the way I treat people. I can see the positive influence that Star Trek has had on me, and I think it's obvious. Am I a murderer? No. Do I steal or otherwise consciously fuck over other people? Nope. Have I ever attempted genocide? Not even once. Thankfully, the Gospel of TNG is pretty lenient when it comes to sex, drugs, and other general debauchery. As long as you make your duty shift, you can indulge in all the carnal pleasures you want. You can even rise to second in command while banging everything in sight. So in my opinion, Star Trek The Next Generation is the basis for an above-average modern morality system. I know it sounds like I'm joking, but I swear to you, I'm not. Living my life according to the teachings of Picard is a deeply held belief. But imagine I told you that I wasn't going to issue you a marriage license because of this belief. Imagine if because of a thin subplot never brought to fruition on the show, something about Barclay, maybe. Imagine because of that religious justification, I denied you anything. A marriage license, a job, hell, a fucking taco. You'd be pretty fucking pissed, wouldn't you? Hell, imagine I didn't even do that. Imagine I just told you that it was all true. That Star Trek was a holy document sent from the future to teach us the way to the stars. You'd think I was fucking insane, right? That it had a mental breakdown. But I could justify it. I could point to advances in technology heading generally in the direction of Star Trek, flip phones, iPads, Siri. I could explain how the Holy Trek contains references and people that are confirmed in the historical record. Stephen Hawking, Mark Twain, Amelia Earhart. I could twist and mangle physics, quantum theory, and other sciences to justify my beliefs to my heart's content. I could even show you how a warp field might work using a bowl of water, a paper boat, and some soap. How is any of that different from the thinking of what passes for the modern American Christian? I think the Bible has a lot of great stories. Moving stories, things that are very important. Some of these stories even contain details about events in the historical record. Are these stories real? I think they are, in the same way that Star Trek is real to me. These things are a way to pass down stories and history in a way that people will remember and hold dear. It's a way of giving people the tools to think about topics too big to conceive of in any other way. But again, my point. If I said that everything in Star Trek was all 100% factually accurate true, then I'd be an idiot. And most of all, wrong. I'd also be missing the point entirely. Be it Star Trek or the Bible, these stories are true, with a capital T. They don't have to be true in the sense that they actually happened to have a positive impact on mine or anyone else's life. They illustrate the way that we can and should be living as people. They give us examples of how to behave under difficult or unfamiliar circumstances. They act as a template for how to be a good person. Not everything in them is useful. Some of it is made up and makes a little sense. Some parts of it totally contradict other parts. Although Star Trek has significantly less problems than the Bible in this department, since Trek at least had a decent showrunner putting it together. Just to be clear, I'm not trying to mock people's religious beliefs, but I think that we have come to this strange point in history where we are actively pushing aside reason, existing reason that we have all agreed upon, in exchange for superstition of the past. And damn it, at this rate, I'm never going to be able to captain a starship. For numerous reasons. Not if we keep wasting all this time dealing with your weirdly homophobic and radically insecure imaginary friend in the sky, Kim Davis. Oh, and if heaven is filled with Kim Davis types, then someone save me a seat in hell, please. Preferably, one next to some wonderfully slutty ladies. Coming up, a fine example of why the gay marriage ruling should have come a hell of a lot earlier. So grab a drink and take off your underwear. The party's just getting started. For today's show, I spoke with writer James Hamill about the worst homophobe that he's ever encountered, and why the gay marriage ruling made him so fucking sad. But I'll let him explain. What did it feel like when that ruling did come through?
To me personally, it was heartbreaking because I just knew that was not going to be something I will ever get to have. My name is James Hamill. Somehow I thought, even though I drove an Alfa Romeo and listened to Cher in it, that somehow I was in the closet until 26. I remember being very young, and we must have been playing Star Wars, and my friend was just changing his shirt, and I was like, like that. I just thought that was cool. Of course, I'm an auto journalist, so this related to me looking at a car magazine, and it was predicting the new cars for 1999. I imagined 1999, and I thought about that, and I said, oh, well, everyone's going to pretty much guess, if I don't have a girlfriend, that I'm gay, so I guess I'll have to be lay out a plan that I'll be ready to come out and have everyone reject me by that point. And that was how my mind went. I was prepared for my mom to never talk to me, my brother, my dad. I mean, I can't imagine nowadays people being out in high school. When I was in my 20s, when I was, I guess, a twink, I was uncomfortable with my sexuality. I could never feel comfortable even, like, being out in a gay bar with other gay men, like, without drinking or doing drugs, specifically meth. So, I mean, even if a person, like your parents teach you about drugs, it's situations like this that just you happen into. I went to this gentleman's house, mansion, and I swear he was a very odd hoarder. He had to walk in between piles of garbage, but he just said, oh, do you want some powdered refreshment? Or gigantic lines of white, and I was like, I just assumed it was cocaine, because I didn't know anything about meth, and so I just did them, and didn't wind up going home for, like, 3 days. Meth is very quickly addicting. I would not have, you know, done it the first time had I known it was going to be all of a sudden in the back of my mind, constantly telling me, oh, go look, search for some, you know, find someone who'll provide you with drugs. Because in my 20s, I didn't even have a this is another thing about youth in the gay community is, I had no idea how people found a drug dealer or paid for drugs. Because I would just go out and find people who would give them to me. You go out to a gay bar, everyone buys you drinks, gives you drugs, and all of a sudden, it's 4 days later, and you have no idea how many people you've slept with. And that pretty much went on all the way until I skidded into 30. Then, I guess the addiction had increased to where I wasn't just snorting it or smoking it. I was, someone had the brilliant idea of, a lot of people don't know you can even shoot up crystal meth. That is incredibly dangerous, but I just kept pushing the boundaries with it. Like, how much I would do in a dose, I would just keep upping it. And, I mean, I'm surprised sometimes my heart didn't explode, you know, at some of the amounts I was doing. And I think it was a subconscious desire not to survive. I think it was I was the homophobe in my life. I was the one beating me up. I was the one bullying myself. I hated that, you know, I had to be the gay one. And
when you were in your 20s, your addiction and your sexuality sort of, they played off of each other.
Yeah, and they became intertwined. And I couldn't separate them. And so, I mean, it was me who was like, okay, I need to go to rehab. And everyone's like, wait, what? What are you doing? I really did not keep being gay a secret very well, but I guess. So I went to a rehab in Laguna Beach. And it was like summer camp for the clinically insane. I have never met so many characters, and just, you know, they sort of come in and then go out of your life. I just figured it would be better to sort of start fresh down here. And I lived in Laguna Beach. I actually wound up managing a house that was block from the beach that was like the just for gay men. And you don't know drama until you have managed the real world house in a gay, you know, rehab. And that was, I mean, the best thing that came out of that was I met Michael Bennett, who then, unlike, you know, a lot of the other people I met, he remained a constant in my life. One of our first real conversations, he was an incredibly intelligent man. He, you know, since he was 2 years old, was in a study with Yale University, just because of his high IQ. Yeah, at 2 years old, he corrected his mother for mispronouncing Dostoevsky. And that was also, I think, the same year that he told his teacher he was going to be Tina Turner for Halloween. So that was kind of him in a nutshell, was this bigger-than-life, flamboyant soul. And funniest person I ever met. Our first real discussion, we got into an argument because he was being extremely dismissive of everything that I was saying. We were sitting outside on the patio back when I smoked, and he smoked. I remember he followed me into the house, and I was going out to my car, and he said, "Oh, well, then you go then." It was something like back to the back alleys or the gutter with you or something like that. So I turned around and I looked at him, and I walked up right to his face, like maybe an inch away, put my finger up to his like eyeball, and I said, "You get one of those in your life. One. And you've used it up. Remember that." Like, and I turned on my heel and slammed the front door as hard as I could. And later he told me that that was the moment he knew I was the one. I wasn't intimidated by any of his defense mechanisms. We never had a desire to use together or anything like that. That was like the last thing we would ever, you know, for two addicts to get together and have that never cross each other's minds. It was like the last thing we wanted for each other. I mean, he just brought joy to my life and made me realize that I could care that much about someone.
Did you ever imagine having a husband, maybe even a family?
No, I was never expected to have kids, even though, you know, like after my niece was born, Courtney, who's six, I realized how much I actually loved kids. I mean, she was the first newborn I ever held. With him, I would have done it even though we were still arguing over the name. He wanted to name our son Mountain, and I refused to do that.
Well, being a Game of Thrones fan, that's kind of awesome.
That's kind of, well, this was before Game of, so I guess he was just ahead of his time.
He was ahead of his time.
Yeah. Then he was also like, "Well, how about the middle name Langston?" And I was like, I was like, "You can't go Mountain Langston."
Langston. That's actually kind of a cool name.
Langston Mountain. But I was ready to adopt a kid and name him Mountain. I mean, I don't know how he, you know. And he had to literally chase me for 6 years and explain to me what love was and what caring was. Because in the beginning, it was essentially, you know, he'd try to like hug me and be like, "I don't like being touched." You know, if I was sober, like that was, I was so unused to that. I realized I was in love with him when I was in my car, and I realized that every minute I wasn't thinking about something that was vital or essential, like eating or breathing or whatever, that I was thinking about him or where he was or what he was doing. He was here in Orange County at a rehab sober living. I remember getting the message from his mom that Michael died last night, and just falling on the couch and feeling like I was falling into a grave, just into the earth, and it was weird. I don't know how long I laid on the sofa. His mother, literally, Cheryl, I still go out and visit her every year on his heaven date in January when he passed away, when he took his life with an overdose. And I can't tell you how many times she put him through rehab and, you know, believed in him and honestly, every time he went, he intended to get sober, but there would always be some yokel who'd be like, oh, hey, Michael, wanna, you know, and he was always trying to make people happy because he never really got that from
anywhere
else. His dad. Yeah, essentially. Right now, at least in my life, I can't see myself finding anyone who would be as interesting or captivate me or make me want to do all that. I guess you could say he was my lobster. Sorry to quote my friends and her friends, but yeah. And I never would have thought so when I met him. Because, yeah, we got into an argument. But that was just like foreplay, I guess. For
Do you think that if the Supreme Court decision had happened 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah. We would have been married and divorced like 6 times by now. Because he like knew the law so well, it would be like we'd get into a fight at lunch, and he'd have us divorced by dinner, and then we'd make up after dinner, and then he'd have to remarry us again, probably. I mean, that probably would have been us.
What did it feel like when that ruling did come through?
As I think you read in a Facebook post, I was ecstatic for all the people across the country who'd just been waiting years to be able to make their unions officially recognized. But to me personally, it was heartbreaking because I just knew that was not going to be something I will ever get to have. No one for me will be able to replace Michael Bennett in my heart. I mean, I may meet someone nice, and I'm sure if he was here, he'd probably be saying, "Poos, get laid for once in a while." I mean, Jesus. But honestly, once he died, it's very hard for anyone to pique my interest or, you know, for me to notice anyone or go on a date. I felt like I had gone through all of this with this one person and knew them so well. Then they were gone, and I just, I mean, at the very least, I had those 6 years with him. That's more than a lot of people get with, you know, they get married to someone they kind of like and go through it and just tolerate them. He understood love, and he was sensitive, but he could never cut off his feelings quite like maybe I could more than him, and it made him a little more susceptible to the slings and arrows of a cruel world. But I mean, that was the other thing that really made me sad about it, was that he couldn't see it or take part in having his own wedding, because he had such a specific view of exactly what he wanted. The first time he tried to kill himself, he was 14 or 15, and it was just his mom had like a premonition and turned the car back around, and they found him in the tub, and I thank her all the time for giving me the amount of time that I had with him. So thank you, Cheryl, and thank you, Michael.
Well, what advice would you give to somebody who is struggling with something like being gay?
It might be scary, but... And people might say hurtful, mean things to you. But be as loud as you can about it, as honest as you can about it, and make people understand how you feel. Your being gay or being bi or lesbian or transgender isn't something you're doing to them. It's just something that you are. And it doesn't define you. You're still you. This is just an aspect that makes up you as a person. But it doesn't define your value or your character.
James Hamill is a freelance auto journalist. You can find him at infotainmentexperts.com or at his Twitter handle at James Hamill Car OC at James Hamill Car OC. Bigots like to cry about censorship these days. Vocal anti-gay idiots scream about how they are the ones being discriminated against. What they're really annoyed about is that they have to pay a price for believing the things they believe. For centuries, LGBTQ people had to pay a price. They either pretended to be something they weren't or found ways to survive as social outcasts. In some ways, LGBTQ people had the luck to be able to hide if they were able to and they so wished. You can't put brown skin in the closet, and us colored folks have been subject to a lot of bad shit too. It's not a competition, though. Luckily, society is changing. For the better, mostly. LGBTQ people are now becoming more widely accepted, as are brown people. As always happens, societies change, and those on the margins get folded into the whole. But the bigots aren't happy about that. They never are. Go back 100 years and show the average American tape of JFK or Conan O'Brien, and they'd go into an apoplectic fit about those dirty, no-good Irishmen. But that's how things go. It's called progress. But bigots claim that people like me are trying to censor them. For the record, I have no desire to see bigots censored in any way. If anything, I want them to speak up. It lets me know who the assholes are. And our government and the media, they're not censoring homophobes and racists either. What's happening is that the bigots are being asked to pay a price they don't feel like paying. They don't feel like paying it because they've never been asked to pay it before. They feel like they've been societally upcharged. 20 years ago, a homophobe could be his true, honest self and pay no social price whatsoever. In the past, the average bigot could say whatever they wanted and rest assured that the room was with them. Today, bigots can still be who they are and think what they want, but they have to pay the social price. They're the ones who are receiving pushback from society for being who they genuinely are, and they don't like it. It's not fun to have people look at some aspect of who you are and shake their heads in shame. But they don't quite see the connection, I think. Of course, we're still not entirely there. Donald Trump and the Republican presidential field show how far we have to go. I mean, have you ever seen so many white men try so very hard to walk the thin line to avoid getting racist, misogynist, and homophobes angry while not being overtly bigoted? But things do change. We're seeing more acceptance for living the lifestyles that people want to live. Being who they are. We're seeing less emphasis put on the color of your skin. And one day, I hope we'll get to a point where we'll be able to say that bigot is the new black. Although, I guess really in context, that could mean that bigot is like a black dress that everyone has. So maybe... Maybe just one day bigots won't exist. How about that? One day bigots won't exist. It's not as catchy, though. Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? Well, on that powerful and extremely well-thought-out note, that's all we have for today. Today's show was brought to you by me. If you'd like to test drive the 2016 Jason Majors, then come by our showroom. I'd like to thank my guest, James Hamill. James owns infotainmentexperts.com, and to quote him, if people want car advice or homo advice, his Twitter handle is JamesHamillCarOC. Please visit MajorSexParty.com and like and tweet and tumble all over us on our various social media platforms. Search for the hashtag MajorSexParty and I'm sure we'll pop up. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so that you never miss any of this wonderful filth. You can listen to past episodes, including the live Major Sex Party panel shows that I do from time to time. They're a lot of fun, and I think you'll enjoy them. Hey, and if you have any story ideas for future shows, just go ahead and email me at story@MajorSexParty.com. Again, if you have a thought or idea for a future show, go ahead and email it to me at story@MajorSexParty.com. Coming up on next week's party, pain and suffering. It can't all be orgasms and oxytocin, people. So let's celebrate the good times and talk a little about the bad times. Either way, come on and join the fun at Jason Major's Sex Party. The reason that I'm not a nihilist is someday I want to live like in Star Trek. And I know that we'll never build starships until we tackle poverty, war, and hardships. So we fight overnight and over lifetimes, organized for that warp drive. And of course, I